This morning we're starting a new sermon series that I'm calling Taking a Stand for Truth. We are going to be looking at each of the, what we call the minor prophets. There are 12 of them. And we're going to take one Sunday per prophet. So this isn't going to be a verse-by-verse exposition of each of the books. We've done that over through some of the minor prophets. But this particular series is not going to be that way. This Sunday, we're going to look at the prophet Hosea. But before we break into that book and this study, I want to give you just a little bit of an overview of these prophets. If this is something that is new to you, then there's some basic information that will be of help to you. When we talk about the prophets, we frequently break them down into writing and non-writing prophets. When we talk about non-writing prophets, we're often talking about prophets like Elijah and Elisha. It's not that they didn't write. We don't know if they did or not. It's that their works are not extant. That is, they didn't get preserved for us. So we don't have anything in our Bible from the prophet Elijah, for example. So we call Elijah a non-writing prophet. Doesn't make him less important. It's just the fact that he didn't have something written for us that we have in our hands today. When it comes to the writing prophets, there are two kinds. There are what we call major prophets, and there are what we call minor prophets. Now, the major prophets are Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. These four men are not major in that they are more important and their works are more significant. It's simply major because their works are more weighty. That is, they used up more paper and ink in order to write down their words. And so we call them major in that sense. Only has to do with length. Now the minor prophets, where we're going to be focusing our attention, are 12 in number. From Hosea to Malachi. Now, in Jesus' day, they didn't call them the minor prophets. They called them the 12. There are 12 of them, and the totality of all of those verses making up those 12 books is far less than just the book of Isaiah. Now, Isaiah is 25% more than all of the 12 minor prophets put together. So the 12 were all able to be put on one scroll, which is why they stuck together. So these 12, about 480 is when we start calling them the minor prophets, are collected and are so identified, not because they're less important, not because their revelation has some kind of minority status. It's simply because they're smaller books. Now, in the piece of paper that was handed out to you, if you're listening to this online, the PDF that attaches to this message, you have a graphic here of all of the kings in the United Kingdom and in the Divided Kingdom from Saul in 1043 all the way down to Zedekiah, who was the last king in the nation of Judah. And you have attached to that the prophets that are connected with that period of time. Now, I included Elijah and Elisha, two non-writing prophets, along with some of the others. Now, as you look at this particular chart, not all of the prophets are there because some of the prophets preached. They had their ministry during and after the exile of Judah. Here we have Judah going into exile from 605 was the first deportation to 586, the third and final deportation. And you have the prophets Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi that are not even on this list that preached after the exile. That gives you an overview of the book, or of the series, and of this particular chart. Today we're looking at Hosea, He preached down here, 8th century. Hosea had a rather long ministry. From chapter 1, verse 1 that we're going to look at in just a minute, we see that he had a ministry that spanned some 40 years. There are some scholars who believe that Hosea's ministry lasted as long as 65 years. It was quite lengthy. He saw an enormous amount of change in his ministry years. His name, Hosea, means salvation. It is like Joshua, Jesus, the King Hoshea, which you'll find right here, the last Hebrew prophet, Hebrew king, or king in Israel. All of those names mean salvation. Now, the difference between Hosea's name and Jesus' name, or Joshua's name, is Joshua and Jesus add to that name that Yahweh is salvation. Hosea, his name just means salvation. He is sometimes called the Jeremiah of Israel. Now, you'll notice that Jeremiah lived 100 years after Hosea. But Jeremiah was one who experienced his prophecy up close and personal. He lived what he was preaching. And we're going to find that the very same thing was true in Hosea's life, as he ministered to the northern tribes of Israel. In Hosea, look at chapter 1, verse 1. It says this, "The word of the Lord which came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel." So now you can find from this chart, here we have Hosea. Here's the four kings of Judah that he mentions. And he mentions Jeroboam, son of, let me see here. It says Joash in the New American Standard Translation. Jehoash and Joash are different spellings of the same name for the same guy. Don't be confused. Don't think I made a mistake there. But there's different spellings. As a matter of fact, you'll find that in a couple of different places here on this chart. And sometimes it's difficult to track down, well, who is this exactly? Sometimes there are kings on this list that went by four different names. So sometimes it's a little difficult to identify exactly which one we're talking about. But this is the time frame that we're talking about for Hosea's reign. Before we can talk about Hosea specifically, we need to see what was going on in the country nationally. So I'm going to walk you back 100 years before Hosea, even though we've already opened the book, because this will give us context to understand what life was like as Hezekiah or as Hosea stepped up to the plate and said, "Here I am, Lord. Send me. Let me be your spokesman." I'm going to go back 100 years, but I'm going to go back quite a few books in the Old Testament. I'm in 2 Kings chapter 9. Okay, we've gone back 100 years. And right now, we're talking about Ahab being king in Israel. Who's his wife? Sweet Queen Jezebel. Ahab and Jezebel brought all kinds of pain, problem, and immorality into Israel by way of their Baal worship. Not only did they infect the northern tribes of Israel, they infected the nation of Judah. Here's how. Ahab, Jezebel, had a daughter. Her name was Athaliah. Athaliah married the son of the king of Judah. King of Judah is Jehoshaphat. He had a son by the name of Jehoram. And Jehoram married Athaliah, who appears here, who was Ahab and Jezebel's daughter. Now, Athaliah shows up on this map because she was an illegitimate usurper of the throne. Athaliah was the one who brought Baal worship into Judah with a vengeance. Now, Ahab, Jezebel, and all of the company there. Now, you see, because of marriage, Judah and Israel are locking arms here together. They brought all kinds of problems and distress into the nation. And God pronounced His judgment on Ahab and his household. And He worked out this judgment a couple of generations later through a man called Jehu.
Jehu, son of Nimshi.
Now, I call Jehu the metal detector man because of the way he drove his chariot. 2 Kings chapter 9, verse 20. A watchman reported, "The driving is like the driving of Jehu, the son of Nimshi, for he drives furiously." Jehu was a general in Joram's army. And here he was on assignment, and he was driving his chariot like he always drove his chariot. It wasn't just with a lead foot. This guy had a steel plate for a foot. And he hit the pedal to the metal when he was driving his chariot. This, everybody knew Jehu was coming by the way that he drove his chariot. And that's how he lived life, and that's how he ruled the nation. He was given the responsibility by God to annihilate, eradicate, completely remove Ahab and his household. Now, Ahab himself was dead at this time. Jehu killed the king of Judah and the king of Israel, who were in cahoots with each other. He killed Queen Jezebel, who was still alive at this time. We find in chapter 10 that he gathered all of the living male descendants of Ahab, 70 in number, and killed all of them at one time. And he says in chapter 10 of 2 Kings, verse 16, "Come with me," he says to another man, "and see my zeal for the Lord." He thought he was doing God's bidding. And in many respects, he was. Simply not in the manner in which God would be pleased. And we find in verses 18 and following, his crafty, sneaky way of getting all of the Baal worshippers, all of the Baal priests, all of the Baal prophets together in one location. He said, "Ahab served Baal a little, Jehu will serve him much." It was all a ploy to get them to this one particular place. And then he said to his men, who surrounded this particular building in their as they were doing their Baal worship thing, he said to his men, "Not one of them shall leave this place alive." And we read in verse 28 of chapter 10, "Thus Jehu eradicated Baal out of Israel." Yay! However, verse 29, as for the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin, from these Jehu did not depart, even the golden calves that were at Bethel and that were at Dan. Jehu was plastic. On the outside, it looked like he was a man of God. And yet on the inside, he was riddled with spiritual adultery. Because of that, it says in verse 32 of chapter 10, "The Lord began to cut off portions from Israel." He was pruning them. He was cutting them down. They were trusting in their military strength. He was trusting in what they were able to offer the world. And God whittled them down. Jehu's son, Jehoahaz, had this as an army. Chapter 13, verse 7. He had 50 horsemen. He had 10 measly chariots and 10,000 footmen. He had nothing. They were nothing. But Israel, at this point, did not get the point. Now, Jehu's grandson, Jehoash, had some moxie. He had some strength. He had some wisdom. And he brought a little bit of political strength to the nation. Ah, Jeroboam the second, Jehu's great-grandson, was a wonderful military ruler. Not a saved man. On the outside, plastic, just like his great-granddaddy. But he brought Israel to a place of political strength and economic, strength, economic stability. Now, more than that, they were very comfortable. But they were morally repugnant. So after this bit of a swell, as Jehu was on the throne, there was this dip. And then they swelled back up to Jeroboam the second's reign. And here is where God calls Hosea onto the scene. Because God has been seeing a pattern in the nation of Israel, among the tribes, the northern tribes. He has been seeing a pattern that on the outside, the people do a spit and polish job. They look spiritual. They talk about God. They call on His name. But it's plastic. On the inside, there is nothing but spiritual adultery. Because in their heart, they aren't following the Lord. They aren't trusting in the Lord. They are trusting in all kinds of other things. They're trusting in their bank accounts. They're trusting in their strength militarily. But they're not trusting in the Lord. And so from here on, the nation of Israel plummets. Now I'm going to zoom in here on the life of Hosea and what is surrounding him. There are six kings following Jeroboam the second, serving in the northern tribes of Israel. There are four assassinations. Five different dynasties. Instability run amok. The Assyrians are hammering down on them, beginning in the reign of Menahem. And all of the people are grossly heavily taxed, in order to placate the Assyrians and make them go away. And so the people are languishing inside, all the while God is calling them back to Himself through men like Hosea, but they refuse to listen. Turn back to the book of Hosea. This is the spiritual condition of the people as Hosea begins his ministry. Chapter 4, beginning in verse 1. Listen to the word of the Lord, O sons of Israel, for the Lord has a case against the inhabitants of the land, because there is no faithfulness or kindness or knowledge of God in the land. There is swearing, deception, murder, stealing, and adultery. They employ violence so that bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore, the land mourns, and everyone who lives in it languishes. The kings were examples of drunkenness. The priests encouraged people in their sin, as Hosea describes. If you look over at chapter 8 in Hosea's book, they cry out to God, it says in verse 2, "My God, we of Israel know you." But the indictment of God is just the opposite. In chapter 5, verse 4, in the middle of that verse, Hosea writes, "A spirit of harlotry is within them, and they do not know the Lord." Chapter 4, verse 6, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge." They did not know the Lord. They were simply deceiving themselves in thinking that they were. It was all of this externals that caused Hosea to point the finger at them and say, "You are guilty of spiritual adultery." Now that's the national tragedy that Hosea witnesses. And one author, whose name I don't know, said this of Hosea and his time: "What we see in the prophet of Hosea are the last few swirls as the kingdom of Israel goes down the drain." God called this man, Hosea, to live a life that reflected the national tragedy that was around him. What Hosea was going to experience personally was what was going on in the land nationally. You probably know a good portion of the story of Hosea. In chapter 1, verse 2, that story begins to unfold for us. In the first three chapters of this particular book, they are more personal in nature because this is Hosea's personal family experience. Beginning in chapter 4 through chapter 14, in those 11 chapters, we have Hosea, without any comparison specifically to what was going on in his family, we have him describing for us the problems in Israel and God's promises to reconcile and bring the people back. Hosea chapter 1 verse 2 begins his personal story. "When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, 'Go take to yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry, for the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord.'" Now, it's at this point that many Bible teachers will categorize the book of Hosea as an allegory, or as symbolic, as not a literal thing. Because, so the argument goes, in Leviticus chapter 21, verse 7, it says that God's priests are not to marry women who are adulterers. Shouldn't marry harlots or women who are adulterers. So, the logic goes, God would never call his prophet, Hosea, to really marry a woman from the red light district. Well, it is true that Mosaic law does have those stipulations for priests. And though Hosea is a prophet and not a priest, he certainly has a keen level of responsibility before the Lord. But this particular account is written for us after the fact. And by way of the detail that we find in this story, like his soon-to-be wife's dad's name, Diblaim, being identified, the fact that she bore a son, and then a daughter, and then a son, those kind of details don't fit with an allegory, but with an actual historical record. I think there is another way for us to understand this calling of God to His prophet to say, take for yourself a wife of harlotry. It's my opinion, and there are different ways to interpret this, it's my opinion that Gomer, Hosea's wife, was not a prostitute when they wed. But God knew her wandering heart. And in His omniscience, He knew the choices she was going to make. Written after the fact, Hosea looks at this whole experience and interprets that for God to have said to him, take unto yourself a prostitute as your wife. At the time of their marriage, I don't think she was. But she soon came to be such. Verse 3 continues, so he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, name him Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. On that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Then she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. And the Lord said to him, name her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel that I would ever forgive them. Verse 8, when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said, name him Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. So here is Hosea. He takes Gomer to be his wife, and she bears three children. The first is Jezreel, whose name means sown or scattered by God. Jezreel, by simply his name as he walks around, was an impending prophecy of the exile, or rather the scattering of the tribes of Israel by the Assyrians. The second child was a daughter. Lo-Ruhamah, if you look at your footnote, means she has not obtained compassion, or the name could also mean not loved. Can you imagine naming your daughter not loved? Here in this family, we have a wonderful example of how the life of a pastor or a prophet in this case can be like a fishbowl, because you just can't hide anything. And here is this daughter who wears the name not loved. Not because she was not loved in her home. We don't have any record of what happened in the inner workings between mom and dad and daughter. But she was a constant reminder to everybody who saw her that God was judging His people. And then there was Lo-Ami, a boy whose name means, according to the footnote, not my people. God made that declaration to His people through His prophet in order to draw them back to Himself. You notice in verse 2 of chapter 1, where God says, take for yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry. I think because of the language used in verse 6 and again in verse 9, that it was after the first child was born, Jezreel, that Gomer began acting out as a prostitute. And I think that these next two children, Lo-Ruhamah and Lo-Ami, though born in Hosea's house, were not his children. I think they were children of her adulteries. But we don't have to do a paternity test here in order to discern if these are Hosea's kids or not, because it becomes immaterial. After the third child is born, Gomer is gone. She completely abandons the family, and Hosea is there raising two boys and a daughter all by himself. Now, the nation knows who this guy is. He is a prophet. He is a guy who has stood up and has preached to the people. And now, living right before their very eyes, his wife is off with another man. And then with another man. And then with somebody else. And he becomes a living example of what God deals with in terms of the nation of Israel. The nation of Israel are not only physical adulterers, they are spiritual adulterers. We read in chapter 2 that Hosea, seeing his wife in a pitiable condition, provides food and clothing for her. Yep, she's still sleeping around. She's still not with her family. She's still not being a mother. And yet Hosea shows compassion on this wayward woman. It is yet again another picture of God's gracious work on behalf of His people, Israel, who were not responding to Him. When we get over to chapter 3 of the book of Hosea, we find in this chapter maybe one of the greatest chapters of grace in the Old Testament. Let's read it together. It's only 5 verses. Then the Lord said to me, "Go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes." Now, in all the digging I've done this week, I still cannot figure out what this bit about loving raisin cakes is all about. If you find out, please tell me. I don't think it has anything to do with raisins. I don't think raisins are bad things. As whatever it is, they loved raisin cakes, but the point of the matter is they turned to other gods. Yet, God persisted in His love. He persisted in keeping His end of the covenant. Remember that. We're going to come back to that. Verse 2. So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. You see, Gomer got it. It got so bad for her. She went from one man to another man to no man because nobody wanted to be with her. She was in such a state of ruin and wreck. She says over in verse 2, then she will say, verse 7, "I will go back to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now." But she couldn't. It was too late. And she wound up in slavery. It was there that Gomer found her and he bought her back. Verse 3 of chapter 3. Then I said to her, "You shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So I will also be toward you." In other words, he put her in exile to finish the discipline that had been started by the Lord. Now, discipline is not just punishment. Discipline is intended in order to restore. And that's what Hosea purposed for his wife. Verse 4. For the sons of Israel will remain many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, and without ephod or household idols. Afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to His goodness in the last days. And it is even now that Israel is still in a state of spiritual exile, waiting for the discipline of the Lord as He puts them aside to be completed in order that then they come to their King and to their God. And then they will know the Lord. Now that's Hosea's personal story. And that's his tragedy. But the message doesn't stop there. Indeed, there is a profoundly appropriate and relevant prophetic message even for us today, as it was in Hosea's day, as it was in Jesus' day, as it was 1,000 years ago. This message is completely relevant to us today. We live in a culture, my friends, where adultery, physical adultery, is epidemic. But we live in a world where spiritual adultery is pandemic, where it crosses cultural lines and has infected all peoples around the globe. Sadly, we find some of this infection in churches where people who have heard the name of God proclaimed again and again and would even say, along with those people in Hosea's day, yes, we know the Lord. They may be those who stand before the Lord on the last day, and He will say to them, depart from me, for I never knew you. My friends, we here in this room, in my hearing, are guilty of spiritual adultery when we put our faith and we put our trust in anything other than God. Sometimes the idea of spiritual adultery is not something that we typically think about. I'd like to make some comparisons between physical adultery and spiritual adultery to help you see how pandemic it really is. I put place in your notes for this what physical and spiritual adultery have in common. I've got four things in mind here, and there may be many others, but we'll just talk about these four. Both of them are violations of God's law. It says in black and white, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, that it is God's will. If ever you want to know what God's will is, it is your sanctification, namely your sexual purity. God has a great deal to say about our physical purity in a sexual way. Now, you teenage types, you pre-teenage types, you will be tempted beyond your imagination from where you are standing, sitting in this little bubble right now. But I urge you, you need to be making decisions right now regarding your own sexual purity before the Lord and your future spouse, whoever that might be. Both of them are violations of God's law. We just have to go back into the Ten Commandments where we read, thou shalt have no other gods before me, to see that spiritual adultery is idolatry. But it's not just limited to worshiping a building or some kind of statue. It doesn't have to be physical. I can be putting my trust more in government or in doctors. There's a big one for us. I could be putting my faith more in doctors than in the Lord. And that can be a form of spiritual idolatry. Both of them are violations of God's law. Second, both begin with disappointment and dissatisfaction. Now, those are feelings, my friend. And feelings of disappointment and dissatisfaction will come upon us in every kind of relationship. We will be disappointed with God on occasion. But if we persevere, if we work through that in a godly way, even in your own marriage, your relationship with your children, your next door neighbor, work associates, whoever they may be, you will overcome those feelings of dissatisfaction and disappointment. But it's when we fixate on those disappointments and those dissatisfactions that we move into the next phase. The third thing that physical and spiritual adultery have in common is this. They're both fueled by self-absorbing fantasies. We begin fixating on that which is disappointing and that which is dissatisfying in a particular relationship. And then we begin to fantasize about someone else or something else that will take care of me. You see, it's all narcissistic. It's all self-focused. It's all, what is that person or that being going to do for me? When we're dissatisfied with our husbands, ladies, we start thinking about another guy and what he might bring into our life. And we begin fantasizing. Same thing with us guys. When we are dissatisfied with our wife for whatever reason, in whatever way, we start fantasizing about someone else coming into our life to meet that particular need that is going unmet at the time. And rather than turning to the Lord, we are allowing in our mind turning to another person. And that fantasy merely opens up a maelstrom of destruction. Third, the third thing that these two have in common, physical and spiritual adultery, is this. They are a process by which I voluntarily divert my affections from one to another. Oh, I don't get me wrong. We might still pray, oh God, bring healing to our life. But what we're saying with our words in prayer is much different than what we're saying with our actions. And some people, in their hunger, desperation to be healed, for example, will run from one doctor to another doctor, evidencing the fact all along that they're really not putting their trust in the Lord. Maybe it's in lawyers. Maybe it's in politicians that we put our trust. But it's a process where we have our eyes, our devotion moved, shifted from one to another. When it comes to spiritual adultery, anything that is where we put our trust other than in God is a compromise. It is sin. It all begins in the mind. It all begins right here. When King David stood on the veranda and innocently observed a gal in another piece of property in her own backyard by the name of Bathsheba sunbathing, when he looked at her, he did not sin. That was not the problem. The look was not the problem. The linger was the problem. And he voluntarily chose to divert his attention from the Lord, from his wife, to Bathsheba. It all happened in the mind. Now, the sin that takes place in my mind is just as much sin as acting out on it. It's when I act out on it that I involve other people. And the ripple effect of my sin buries others as well. God's delight is that we show loyalty and faithfulness in our love. Love for our spouse, love for our family, love for our God. I want you to turn with me to chapter 10 of Hosea's book, verse 12. He exhorts the people in his hearing. Sow with a view to righteousness. Reap in accordance with kindness. Break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord until He comes to rain righteousness on you. You have plowed wickedness. You have reaped injustice. You have eaten the fruit of lies because you have trusted in your way, in your numerous warriors. You've trusted in all kinds of other things. Put your trust in God, not in your ways. Turn a page over to chapter 6, verse 6. Hosea 6:6, for I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice, and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. The other major translations I checked, like NIV, King James, New King James, read this way in verse 6, for I delight in mercy. That particular Greek word, the Hebrew word, is the word chesed. If you don't feel like you're spitting, you're not saying the word right. Chesed begins in the back of the throat. It's sometimes called translated mercy, sometimes translated love, sometimes translated loving kindness. The root of that particular word means steadfastness. And it has to do with the response of two parties that have made a covenant with one another. They are to have a chesed response to the covenant. That is, they are to be loyal to the covenant. They are to be faithful to the covenant. So in that sense, they show love. So sometimes Hosea is called the prophet of chesed, because this particular concept comes up over and over again. Not only because he showed chesed to Gomer, that is, he was faithful to her, even in her unfaithfulness. But more perfectly, it shows God's faithfulness, His loyal love to the people that He made a covenant with, the nation of Israel. He was faithful in His commitment to keeping His end of the bargain. Even though they were rebellious, even though they were spiritual adulterers. And my friends, that's our calling. As redeemed people of God, we have experienced the chesed love of God. We have experienced His loyalty, His faithfulness, His steadfastness to us. And that is our calling. This last week we put up new calendars on the wall. In 1990, as people in the United States were putting up new calendars, celebrating not just a new year, but a new decade, the Chicago Tribune printed photos, not just of the previous year, 1989, but of the previous decade. And in their photo essay was one particular picture. It was by Michael Fryer, who captured a grim fireman and a paramedic carrying a fire victim away from the scene. The blaze, which happened in Chicago in December 1984, at first seemed routine. But then firefighters discovered the bodies of a mother and five children huddled in the kitchen of an apartment. Fryer said the firefighters surmised, she could have escaped with two or three of the children, but couldn't decide who to pick. She chose to wait with all of them, for the firefighters to arrive. All of them died of smoke inhalation. And the author concludes, there are times when you just don't leave the ones you love. That is chesed. That is loyal faithfulness that doesn't give up, that loves and loves and loves, though you get squashed in the mud, spit in the face, you love and you love and you love. That is how God treated me. I know it firsthand. That's how I treated you too. We, my friends, can do nothing less. That is the message of Hosea. Let's pray. Our Father and our God, we are humbled to realize your kindness, your love, your mercy, your loyal faithfulness to us. Though we were rebels, yet Christ died for us. We, of all people, are most blessed. And we give all the praise, all of the thanksgiving, all of the glory to you alone.